Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you risk to escape a brutal political regime and a life of utterly hopeless poverty? If they are caught, tens of thousands of North Korean defectors hiding in China right now face deportation and then years of hard prison labor as punishment. There are also grave risks for those who escape official abuse, including abusive labor situations and even enslavement to those who know their secrets. But thanks to humanitarian groups and sometimes for-profit smugglers, some defectors do manage to make it to South Korea, where there is a chance for asylum and even full citizenship. Tom O'Neill chronicles some of these journeys in the current issue of National Geographic magazine, where he is a senior writer. The article is called Escape from North Korea, and we're pleased to have him here to talk about it. Tom, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Great to be here.
Let's start with this, because you had really amazing up-close access to these two young women that you profile in the piece. Can you talk about how you were able to find them and to convince them to trust you?
Well, the Geographic for a long time has been trying to do something on North Korea to break into that closed society. In fact, a couple years before, I went with a photographer to simulate a story in North Korea, show them how we'd interview and take pictures, and they couldn't stand it. They, after a week, they said it was too uncomfortable. So we thought, how else can we get some kind of document of what life is like inside that? And then we started hearing reports of these thousands of North Koreans that had come across the border into China where they were hiding. And we decided, let's try it. And we spent another year just trying to find who could give us access, who would allow the safety of both the defectors and us, the photographer and writer, to do it. And we came across a Korean, South Korean pastor named Chung Ki-won, who was one of the founders of this Asian Underground Railroad. And he had had some decent dealings with the press, and I think it was a time that he wanted to give publicity to this issue. So it was his overture and common friendships that he decided he would give us a chance. And we only had a short window of time, maybe a couple weeks at the border. If there were people that had escaped and were ready to go across China, then we would be able to meet them. And the week we were there was about a year ago. It was freezing about now when the river is frozen. People are crossing. Everyone's inside. But he had heard that there were two women that had worked in a sex industry, a chat room, and they had just gotten out. They had escaped their owner, and they were in a safe house. So we got the call. We had just been waiting, posing as honeymooners, my wife and I, who would act as my interpreter. The call came from Korea saying, these people are ready to escape. Go meet them. And that started this tale. And there were ground rules, Chris. Before we even went to China, we had agreed not to publicize the names of any of the missionaries or human rights activists in China that were helping us or the defectors. We would not show the faces and photographs of the defectors unless they gave us explicit permission, and we would not give details of the routes, precise details. So once those ground rules were accepted, they said, come to China in this week in the winter. And we came there, and the two women were there, and we went up the shabby high-rise building, knocked on the door, and there they were, scared to death, but on the verge of taking off on a train across China. So that's how the story really started for us.
Yeah, these women that you profile, even in your personal notebooks, you call them red and white for fear that somebody would intercept those and you would all be in trouble.
Yes, that was also part of the agreement. I couldn't have anything that would lead the security back to them. And we were under no illusions. China monitors journalists as well as their own citizens. They're big listening posts. We could see the satellite dishes and everything. And I had a feeling there were a lot of plainclothes men around the border, so we had to be cautious. I wore a very heavy jacket with a hood around my face at all times just to, I mean, it was probably cheesy. They probably knew where I was, but I wasn't going to call undue attention. And then once I met the two women, I named them by the color of the clothes they were wearing. I didn't put any other notes, and so when my wife, So Young Lee, and I would go back at night for dinner, we would just talk to each other what we heard, because I couldn't put it in the notebooks while I was in China. And it was, we were trying to commit it to memory, the details of their story and so forth. And so we would have this kind of oral history every night. And we had a chance to meet them, I think, three times before they got on the train to China. And each time it got a little better. We'd bring them some oranges. We'd take pictures of them with a digital camera and show them how they looked. They would relax. And So Young, being a Korean, could also speak their language, and it was, they were fascinated by her because she came from the promised land to them, and they fascinated her because they were from a place that was a time warp to her, North Korea, which has been closed ever since the end of the Korean War in 1953. So that fascination with each other helped them open up, and I was almost a bystander for a lot of the interviews. They would just talk and talk, and So Young would tell me what they were talking about, but a lot of it was later at dinner where she would explain more of the details.
Tom O'Neill is my guest. He's a senior writer for National Geographic magazine, which publishes his article Escape from North Korea in the current February 2009 issue. It's very interesting when you talk about this idea that it is, it's been a closed place. One of the people that you talked to who finally made it from North Korea through the circuitous route to South Korea said it was like jumping forward an entire century.
Yes, I think the defectors we met in China, they were naive, they were innocent, even though almost every of them had these searing personal stories of seeing a family member die of starvation or being put in prison for having illegal thoughts. Most of them had been sick or had family sickness. So they had these life experiences that had scarred them, and yet their knowledge of the outside world was very slight. And apparently a lot of the defectors have been able to hear stories of China from traders that have smuggled goods back and forth across the border. There's been some smuggling of soap operas and movies into North Korea, but still their sense of the outside world was a fantasy. I mean, they told my wife that they thought South Korea was just full of cars and riches, and everyone was handsome and successful, and so they had this fantasy, and they weren't prepared. But maybe that allowed them to escape. I think they needed some kind of shining city on the hill that they thought they were going to reach. And I think by the time they got to South Korea, many of them had been hiding for years in China, and the trip itself through the various stages takes more than half a year to get out. I think by the time they got to South Korea, they were exhausted, fatigued, they were tired of detention and hiding, and I think, they were stunned by what they saw, and as once they get to South Korea, they're put into a kind of an education center just to teach them how to use credit cards, how to go to a grocery store, how to set up a bank account, really basic stuff, but they came like babes out of the woods, and it was fascinating to see just a huge divide between a capitalist consumer society in the South Korea and then this closed, kind of rationed life in North Korea. And it shows in 50 years you can just create this chasm of what people expect and are used to. And it's going to take a generation or two of North Koreans to leap that gap rejoin or join the Western or the kind of modern democratic world.
Once they leave, Tom, are North Koreans, do they assume that they will never again be able to have contact with their family back in North Korea?
I think a lot of them go over thinking they'll stay only for a few months, and quite a few do. I mean, thousands keep moving back and forth to get medicine, food, work at some construction and bring money back. But the ones that end up stuck in there, if they've been, most of them are women. I think three-quarters now the defectors are women, which is an unusual refugee situation.
And why are more women there?
I think it's easier for them to find work in China. It's not, I mean, it's trafficking, really. A lot of them are sold to Chinese farmers as brides for $500, $750. A lot of them end up in karaoke bars, prostitutes, these sex rooms, and it's easier for women to escape from North Korea, too. Most of the men are in factories, the military. They're just watched, I think, more closely. At least that's what the women told us. And some of the women said there are whole housing blocks in these North Korean cities that have been are emptied of women now, that just this large passage back. And once they're in North Korea, it's very difficult to speak to their parents, their siblings, their if they have children, because they don't want to get that family in trouble. And I think most of them, as they told me, snuck out without telling their family, because if their family is suspected of helping them, all of them will be put in a gulag as well. So I think it's a, yeah, it's a cutoff. And not, that was one of the most touching, painful things as we talked, just for them to realize they probably would never see their family again. And, oh, God, the homesickness. It was one of the ironies that even after they told all these stories of the horrors of just scraping for food or looking for medicine or having no future and being desperate to escape, most of them were deeply homesick for their families, their neighborhoods, their villages, even their common language. And it just shows that home is, yeah, it gets to a core even more than these privations. So it was, they were struggling emotionally, psychologically, physically, the whole time we were with them.
Yeah, and one of the women was checked over and found to have thyroid cancer that probably would have killed her if she had not escaped.
Yeah, she was the one we called White, and her story was amazing to me because she crossed, I think, in October when the water was... Now, the river they're crossing's less than 100 yards wide, and pretty shallow in the fall, and she waded across after paying a broker to smuggle her across. And the moment she landed on the other shore, she was picked up by, I guess, another broker who had basically sold her to this sex operation where she was kept in a room for a year. So by the time we saw her, she had had no freedom at all. She crossed the river. The next day, she was stuck in this one room doing these pornographic chats. So by the time she escaped, she had no knowledge of the outside world except what comes through a computer and sexual customers on the videotape. And by the time she got to South Korea, she was sick. And they did diagnose her as thyroid cancer.
Let me stop you there, Tom. We have to take a quick break because I want to get the rest of the story. Tom O'Neill is here from National Geographic Magazine. The new article is Escape from North Korea. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom O'Neill is my guest. He's a senior writer for National Geographic magazine and wrote a piece called Escape from North Korea that appears in the current issue. If you want to join our conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you may call 1-800-933-5372. So you were talking again about this woman who had been diagnosed with thyroid cancer, I guess, once she was in South Korea?
Yes. I'd seen her 8 months before when she had escaped into Laos. That was the last time I'd seen her. And even then, because she had been working for this sexual chat room, she wasn't a sexual creature, but she had to dress that way. So she was getting ready to hike with high leather boots and kind of frilly blouse, and it was her costume. When I next saw her, she was in a hospital room, recovering from the surgery, and it was a complete makeover. She was just wearing T-shirt, pajama bottoms, had just had a big scar on her neck, and her voice spoke with a whisper, but it was like a different person. And in that 8 months, she had become religious because people had helping her belong to a church, and she sought strength there. And she just suddenly didn't have this kind of pain in her face, even though she had this surgery. And wow, it was like seeing a different person. It was so great to see her and know that she's doing better. And I think it was touch and go. And last time I heard from her, she is out of the hospital, living in her own place. Her voice has come back. She's trying to get into the university, which South Korea allows subsidies to allow the defectors to get in. So, yeah, I'd agree. If she had been stuck, even in China, much less North Korea, she probably would have died. There's a lot of cancer in North Korea, I think, because of their pollution and industrial processes. And so, White is lucky in many ways, and she feels that. She knows it, which is different. A lot of the defectors are bitter once they come to South Korea. They feel, well, this isn't as easy, or I'm not a hero, or that. But White stands out for that.
Yeah, what's really moving about that photograph, I guess they're all by Chen Chi Chang,
yes,
in the piece, is that it's the first time we see her face. Because throughout the piece, as you're telling this story, and as you mentioned, they were sort of afraid to reveal their faces for the camera.
Yeah, you're right, Chris. It's very powerful in the layout that, she comes in strong. The photograph shows the Pastor Chun Kiwan, who orchestrated the escape with another defector, and White in the hospital room praying. And you're right, showing that face, I think, took this huge, that she could show it to the outside world, took a huge weight off her. But, of course, the reason she could is that she heard that her mother had died during the time of her escape, and her brother, her only surviving brother, had been thrown into prison, and she had lost touch with him. And so that was heartbreaking, too. The reason they show their faces is usually because they know they have no family left in North Korea. They don't feel their family can be harmed. So it was bittersweet for her that she could show the face, but it was only because her family had died or disappeared. She does have a different name. She is new name, I'm so excited to follow her as she moves through life, and even readers are writing in going, can we help her? Can we send money for her education and so forth? So she struck a chord. Yeah.
Tom, you mentioned that some people finally arrive in South Korea where they are often offered full citizenship and they're bitter. Mm-hmm. You write in the piece that they're becoming sort of a permanent underclass because they don't have the same sort of education as their South Korean peers. And they are, I guess, looked upon as very backward people.
Yeah, it is a parallel universe for them. And I think they felt a bit chosen during the escape because people were helping them and they were together with fellow defectors, refugees. it was such an accomplishment for them to reach the Seoul airport where they were flown into. And one defector, I still remember his words to me, he said when he got off the plane, he was so excited, he thought there would almost be a welcoming committee. And one authority came up to him with this look that said, "Why are you here?" And that is something that they keep asking themselves, because they are suddenly come into this society that's hyper-competitive. Education is paramount in South Korea. Go to the best universities, high-speed life. And most of these North Koreans probably average high school education, or most of them much less, very few skills. And most of them are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. So they are put down in a society where, unfortunately, they feel they're hiding still. A lot of the ones I met were embarrassed or wary of going outside. They were just stuck in their apartments. Their accent is very different than a Southern Korean accent, and it gives them away. So there's this, I don't know, a shame, a disappointment, an incredible frustration, because they felt they had mastered all the odds, that they had triumphed. And so most of them are blue-collar jobs. A lot of them are unemployed, turned to crime. There are about 15,000 now. And I have a feeling from going from defector to refugee, now they're almost like immigrants, almost like Latin American immigrants that come to the United States. It will probably take several generations to, you know, just gather themselves to learn the ways of this new life. But it is a century jump for them. And that hiding part is just, it hurts, because I think that promised land they thought they were coming to isn't there. But I have to add, they can eat now. Physically, when I saw the three people that I followed, even white, you could tell there was a burden lifted off of them. They weren't furtive. They weren't kind of shrunk into themselves. So even though it was difficult, for them to walk around or be on their cell phone or to be on a computer, you could tell they were impatient. They wanted to catch up, but you could already tell that their life would be better. It wasn't quite the Hollywood ending that even my wife and I and the photographer thought it would be in the story, because they have a long road to travel. But most of them would say, "I can speak what I want, I can eat three meals a day, and I have a future." So I think that's the beginning for them.
I want to talk about these Christian missionary groups that are there sort of running this underground railroad. I know there are some smugglers also who are making money on this, but how freely are they able to operate, particularly within China?
Not very much. Christianity is tolerated in state churches, which get funding from the church. They can't have any kind of ideological or political sermons, and they're watched pretty closely. Many of the missionaries working for the Underground Railroad have kind of village churches or underground churches where are in homes. I visited a few of them where they put up a makeshift altar, and they fill the house with people that bring Bibles in, and so there's a fervor there. And these missionaries, they're on a crusade. I think they have a little bit of human rights. They want to help the suffering North Koreans, but a large part of it is they want to convert them. And North Korea is a non-religious country. If you are found with a Bible there, people have reported of executions of people found with Bibles. So they have... This stirs a lot of the missionaries on the border, but they're operating very secretly, and we had to be cautious dealing with them, too. Most of the time we met them, it was in private rooms of restaurants or talking in a taxi cab, things that would keep them out of listening range of authorities. And I think with the three people that I profiled, one of them had been converted. He had come over 2 years before, and he was seemed a very authentic Christian, and he wants to go back to North Korea and proselytize, which is very dangerous. I wish he does not, because, yeah, just I got a feeling he'd be caught. For both Red and White, I noticed the missionary, he only had a couple hours to start them on their new world, talking about religion, and, oh, man, it was like this cram course trying to explain who the Holy Spirit was, who Jesus Christ was, and their look of total befuddlement.
It's a lot to take in all in 2 hours.
Yeah, and one thing Pastor Chung Kiwan, the founder, said is, I mean, of the person that the ringleader behind their escape is, most of them are looking for people that help them, and since religion and pastors are the ones that step up often, then they will embrace the faith. But Pastor Chun is a realist. He believes a lot of it's skin deep, that they just need help. They're willing to believe in anything. They've believed in the strong man leader in North Korea, and he's quoted in the story of saying, believing in God, how different is that from believing in Kim Jong-il? I mean, of some deity-like figure. So I think a lot of them are opportunistic, but again, White and Red and Black, I mean, they were all so grateful for the people that helped, and I think they were trying to learn. And, you know, Chris, the missionaries are probably just a slice of the people helping their human rights groups, but still the majority are these brokers or smugglers who don't care about anything except getting their money, and a lot of the money is coming from defectors. The movement, the Asian Underground Railroad, is about 10 years old, and enough North Koreans have come to the South now, started to make some money. They get some government payment. They are sneaking the money back to family members in North Korea so they can escape. So these brokers, yeah, I talked to a few. They never show their face, but they are driven by profit. They'll bribe the right people, but they want to get paid. So they are the lubricant of this system, too. So it's a whole mix of motives. But from my experience, the missionaries seem to, they wouldn't charge the people, and they seem to have aftercare. Like once they got to South Korea, they would follow up with them and make sure they went to church for a little while and so gave that helping hand.
Who pays for those efforts by the church missionaries who are working on this? Are they internationally funded in some cases?
Well, South Korea is this interesting mix now. It used to be kind of a Buddhist nation, but ever since Korean War, Protestant, Catholic religion, mostly Presbyterian, has just really taken off. So I think one-third of Koreans are Christian now, and it just spoke to them. And a lot of South Koreans in Europe, especially in the United States, send money to these missionary groups to fund their work. And I think Koreans are right after Church of the Latter-day Saints is sending missionaries around the world. There was that story a year ago where some were caught in Afghanistan, I think, and they are, yeah, the Korean missionary force is all over the world, and they're funded by the big diaspora of Korean Christians, and their churches are amazing in Seoul, very cathedral-like, many of them. Others are modest, but it's changing the Korean life, Christianity, and defectors are benefiting from it.
I'm curious about the role of the Chinese in apprehending people who have crossed the border, because the border, I suppose, in most places is guarded on the North Korean side, but not as people are entering on the Chinese side. Is that correct?
Yes. But I have to tell you, Chris, by the time I got to the border, I didn't know what to expect. For some reason, I thought it would look somewhat like the DMZ, the southern border between North Korea and South Korea, which has high fences and land mines and constant patrols. But this one seemed strangely abandoned, and there were pillboxes or bunkers on the North Korean side, but pretty primitive looking, and not much on the Chinese side. And it was only later, while we were there, people said, well, North Koreans are catching most people before they get to the border, and Chinese will catch them once they get settled. So the actual border itself wasn't all worked up with military and so forth. And the Chinese have a mixed feeling. I've got to believe they know where almost all the North Koreans are. Wow. I just think that the way they're intelligence works, and there are a lot of neighborhood and or neighboring informants. That's there are rewards for North Koreans, and I think the Chinese protect all their borders with Tibet, Mongolia, Burma. They're just a border conscious country that want to feel secure with their borders are tight and people aren't flooding in. And so I think they let some North Korea, they're probably 50,000, maybe even 100,000 hiding there. And I think they almost let them be, unless, like when Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea, was reported to have a stroke in August last year, China clamped down on the border, much more than during the Olympics, or it was right after the Olympics the stroke was believed to have occurred. They just thought North Koreans would flood over the border, and they just didn't want it to be destabilized. So they're playing a cagey role, but as I point out in the story, they are they have signed the United Nations Human Rights Charter. They're on the executive board of the United Nations Human Rights Council, and yet they are still sending North Koreans that they catch back to North Korea. And
Tom O'Neill, hang on one second. Yeah. Tom O'Neill's here from National Geographic.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom O'Neill is with us. He's a senior writer for National Geographic magazine. He has an article in the February 2009 issue called Escape from North Korea. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. There is one person that you write about in the piece who was a doctor in North Korea. Can you talk about what he discovered when he arrived in South Korea?
Yes, he's the pictured in the last photograph of the story, and he went through his training in North Korea and escaped because it wasn't for political reasons, or he just hated the bureaucracy, the ways, the hypocrisy. But he escaped with a container of mannequins is how he got to South Korea, and once he landed, he...
Wait, he was in a container of mannequins.
Right.
Wow.
Someone had to pry him loose. I think he was suffocating inside it once he got to the Incheon port in South Korea. So he'd already had this adventure, and I think he had probably unrealistic hopes once he got to South Korea, but he found almost all his training, all the equipment he worked with in North Korea, didn't serve him at all. And when I met him in Seoul, he had an office job, but he was studying at night to take the medical exams, and he's still studying. Now, this is almost a year later, and I don't know. he doesn't have confidence he'll pass, but it just showed that the education did not track at all. But again, South Korea is giving a subsidy to the defectors to go to school, and the dropout rate is very high amongst the ones, but this doctor is working hard and taking the night courses, and yeah, I think people like him will stand out. I met another professional who had become a major he was running a restaurant. He and his wife had a noodle factory, and his wife was South Korean. They have a child that's 5 years old, and he has not told his child that he's North Korean. Again, it's that he's now a professional of success, but he's just that shadow is still on him, and it's probably the same as this doctor, where they probably want their past to recede. And yeah, just quickly, the stories we heard on the border were very raw, and I thought very authentic. And by the time we got to Seoul, and we're talking to other defectors that have been there for a period of time, a year, 5 years, most of them no longer wanted to talk about their past. It was too painful, or their story had been so polished, like water over a stone, that some of it it felt, just too good, all the high points. So that was one advantage in the story, to just hear the unvarnished, unplugged tales on the board. By the time they're in Seoul, they have a wrap down because they're trying to get money. They're trying to hide themselves. And so it's a different – and that way they changed their sense of the past has been doctored somewhat.
Do you have any sense, Tom, that the number of people who do go back and forth, and I know it's a relatively small number, that they will start to change the culture within North Korea?
Oh boy, I can't believe that. I think North Korea, one thing, by all these people getting out, shows that North Korea isn't this total controlled society where everything's working by lockstep and everyone is watched. Obviously, there's a lot of hunger. The border guards are vulnerable to being bribed. That's how these people are getting across. So there is a breakdown, which is interesting to learn. I think the ones that go back they just can't speak openly, but they are bringing these soap operas, these movies. And I think that starts to break this bubble that North Korea has. And North Korea divides its people into three classes: the loyal, most of them live in the capital of Pyongyang, the wavering, and then the hostile. A lot of the hostile are in prison, and most of these defectors are wavering. They are part of that class where they're usually poor farmers or factory workers and probably have nothing to lose. And so they're not, I don't know how much they would get into the professional classes to change it. There are radio broadcasts going in, but in my personal opinion, I think only kind of a change of a leader would help. And these nuclear talks going on, I fear that North Korea needs an enemy to glue their society. I feel it's such a dysfunctional place that as long as they keep this us against the world, they can keep their people under their thumb. And so I don't have high hopes for these negotiations. I think North Korea does not want peace under this current regime, because then they wouldn't have anything to rouse their people with. So, boy, I think unification and collapse is way down the road. These dysfunctional countries like Burma or Myanmar, they can last a long time. So that's what I fear.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. So I'm wondering if your author could somewhat clarify the route these people are taking. I'm hearing talk of people in North Korea, and they end up in South Korea, but then I hear mention of China. too. So as I piece it together, these people are at first escaping from North Korea into China, and I would think that would be a less stressful, less arduous escape. Those two countries are fairly similar, is my impression. And then somehow from northeastern China, they find their way back to the Korean Peninsula. And so I'm wondering if you could at least, I don't need necessarily exact cities, but maybe if you could at least vaguely describe the route.
Yeah, and there is a map, by the way, we should say in the magazine that's very helpful, but I'm sure that Tom can give us a rundown of it. It's a long way they have to go.
Yeah, Ed, there have been other routes. The shortest one was through Mongolia, and quite a few in the late 90s, early part of this century, went that route. Chinese have closed that off. Vietnam was another route, easier, again, up in that northeastern quadrant. So now they're left with this long haul across China, and most of them, get on these trains or on a bus or on a truck. They have no documents, so they're hiding out. It's hard to know how many are caught, but the farther they get from that border, they're safer. But we joined two of them, the two women, on the train, and we assumed they were on it. I mean, we saw them right before the train was going to leave, but they had to hide on the train, pretend they were asleep, or get into a bathroom when the guards were coming. And 40 hours later, they got off this train, and that was only part of it. They had to go on foot to cross the mountains into the Golden Triangle of Laos, and then they had to get another ride to the Mekong River, sneak across that. Then most of them are captured in Thailand, and they're there in a detention center while they're waiting to get asylum. So, it is a long time in time and distance. And even Thailand now, the reason they go to Thailand, Ed, is that it's the one border country that is not automatically sending the North Koreans back. But Thailand's hospitality is starting to fray, I can tell. And, the Asian Underground Railroad can be shut off at any time. And I think that's why the Obama administration probably, from what I read, may put pressure on China to quit repatriating them and make human rights more part of the negotiations with these East Asian countries. We'll see, but right now there's very little movement because Thailand's worried and China's borders are still pretty heavily guarded now because they're, again, still worried about the health of Kim Jong-il. But but most of it's happening right there on that little border where Russia, China, and North Korea meet. It's the old Manchuria, and it's very remote, very cold. We were up there about this time last year, and those Siberian winds are just fierce, and the whole city's up there covered by cloud smoke or coal smoke, and it is. It feels like the edge of the earth up there.
The Chinese, in fact, used to look the other way until there was pressure on them from the North Koreans. Is that right?
It is, yeah. In fact, a lot of the stories from the mid-90s, there was a big famine in North Korea in the 96 or right. 97, and several million people died. It was partly for monsoon rains didn't come. There were a lot of deforestation where there were floods that wiped out crops. And there's a big Korean-Chinese ethnic community in China, and they at first took in the defectors, and I think China just didn't think it was going to be a big problem. But once the numbers started to increase, it was a loss of face for Kim Jong-il, and he just thought, he worried, Chris, as you said, maybe information would start filter back into North Korea and undermine his role. And also, China's a huge buyer of iron ore and other minerals from North Korea. And they want to keep friends with North Korea. And they, I think, are willing to just turn the spigot off if North Korea is uncomfortable. And China has an interesting foreign policy. I mean, as we see how they operate in Africa, they need resources, and things like human rights are way down the list of how they're making their decisions. So, it's not as hospitable a place at the border anymore. I think everyone's wary of helping the defectors, and I think that's why they're hiding deeper and deeper.
What would you say is the best that a North Korean defector can hope for?
You mean once they reach South Korea?
Assuming they make it somewhere where they are safe. Yeah, and we'll say South Korea because that's where the majority of them end up.
I think most of them actually do like or didn't mind living in China. They all said, God, if we only had documents, if we only were allowed to work there because it would be near their homeland. The language and the accent is pretty close. I think that's probably what they would want, that China would give them some kind of green card status. Of course, deep down, they want North Korea to fall. But I think one of the fallacies of the sense of this unification where especially the Southern Koreans just think, we'll be combining, we'll show the North Koreans how to do it, we'll take our brothers and sisters in. And the North Koreans I met, they are all taught they are the pure Koreans. They are the ones that have never collaborated with the enemies. They are the ones that beat the Japanese. And I think they sense that they will rule the unification of the peninsula. So you got that psychology in there. So I guess the best they can hope for realistically is that they get to school, they're given some job training, and I think they meet South Koreans so they don't feel like freaks. But about 70 have come to the United States. There is a congressional, I'm not sure what it is, an order or so forth that allows North Korea or United States to bring in North Koreans, and Homeland Security has kind of tightened it now. But I think 70 are here. I think there are a few in the Texas area, and the younger, more educated defectors want to go to the U.S. They feel it'd be a fresher start, even though they wouldn't have the same language. So, in the next, a few years, there may be more coming to the United States. Here in Washington, there are quite a few that live on the eastern seaboard, and I've met a few of them, and they seem to be doing a little bit better.
That's good
than
to
the
know.
Ones in South Korea.
Yeah. Tom O'Neill is a senior writer for National Geographic magazine. His article, Escape from North Korea, appears in the February issue. Tom, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. It was good.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.